You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning, West Hill. I just want to assure everybody, I'm up here again, but this is not a congregational meeting. This is just regular Sunday service. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. Good morning. Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationships we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Recommendation 77. We call upon the provincial, territorial, municipal, and community archives to work collaboratively with the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation to identify and collect copies of all records relevant to the history and legacy of the residential school system, and to provide these to the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
Thank you. Scott normally does the Grounded, Guided, Growing at this time, but his voice is so ragged that we decided to spare it because he's got one of those colds. He often brings you just a window into something that's been going on in the week or something that is happening within the congregation and ties it into these three elements. But I wanted to just speak about them separately without tying them to anything but what it is that we do. It was Scott who came up with these three words some time ago, recognizing that we had so many people coming into this space who had never been here before, who may be coming in to find a traditional United Church congregation, or maybe coming in to find West Hill because they had heard about what it is that you do. We wanted to distill what it is that we do, because congregations within Christian churches generally come together for a particular thing, and we had kind of moved a bit from that. And so as he thought about it, these are the three words that came out as demonstrations and very simple way to speak about what it is we do. We ground our connectedness of life. We recognize that we are not individuals. One of the things that religion has done down through the course of history is to pull the individual out of him or herself and place them in the context of a whole. And that's one of the things that we continue to do here, a very relevant piece of our gathering. We are individually placed within the whole. And that means not just the whole of this community or the whole of the people who think the way we do or the whole of the nation, but the whole of life on this planet. And indeed, beyond. We are members of the human family. We are creatures that live on Earth. We exist within the whirling cosmos. So we are interconnected. We're grounded in love, because once you recognize that you're interconnected with absolutely everything else, you have to figure out how you're going to interact with that everything else. And the way that we choose to do so is through that concept of love, that opening up of our hearts to empathize with others, to feel compassion, to recognize a connection there, to honor that connection by treating it with dignity and recognizing the beauty inherent in the other, whether it is a fern in a New Zealand forest, whether it's the neighbor across the backyard fence, whether it is a recent immigrant to the country. We see in that other a mirror reflection of life, and so we reach out for it, grounded in love. And as soon as we say that we're grounded in love, the question? Guided, what? Guided by love, sorry. Guided, thank you. See, he's got one. Guided by love, we have to recognize that, somebody's understanding of love and what that calls forth from them in one context with one set of ideas and beliefs about how the world functions, and someone else's, that they're very different. And so we have to expose ourselves to those ideas. We have to examine them. We have to take perspectives away from each of our conversations and find what they mean in our own life and move on so we grow in wisdom. So those are the three things that Scott distilled out of what it is we do here on a Sunday morning to easily articulate it for each of us. And as you go from this place and talk amongst your friends or people who have heard about what's going on here, those are the three words I think that can best describe what it is that we do in West Hill. So I share them with you today.
We have three readings today. The first reading is from Alan Harrington. It certainly inhibits a man's desire to change companies for a better job. Thus, it is at least a minor pressure against free-spirited enterprise. All the benefits exert pressures too. There is nothing sinister about them, since admittedly they are for your own material comfort. And isn't that supposed to be one of the goals of mankind? What happens is that, as the years go by, the temptations to strike out on your own or take another job become less and less. Gradually, you become accustomed to the utopian drift. Soon after, another inhibition may make you even more amenable. If you've been in an easy circumstances for a number of years, you feel that you are out of shape. Even in younger men, the hard muscle of ambition tends to go slack, and you hesitate to take a chance in the jungle again. The second reading, from Gail Forman. So this is how it's become. This is how I've become. A walking contradiction. I'm surrounded by people and feel alone. I claim to crave a bit of normalcy, but now that I have some, it's like I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to be a normal person anymore. And the third reading, from Tara Kelly. Normal is an ideal, but it's not reality. Reality is brutal. It's beautiful. It's every shade between black and white, and it's magical. Yes, magical. Because every now and then, it turns nothing into something. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Focused Moments, from Greta Vosper.
Like about stories that movies that are based on true stories is I don't have to like not tell you what happens, right? Because you can find out what happens, but I won't tell you about some of the key things in the movie. I've seen Lion. How many of you think it might be the one that gets Best Picture? I think it was a phenomenal film. Just so powerful, a powerful true story about a child who got lost and became one of what the at the end of the movie tells you. Currently, 8,000 children are lost, are disconnected from their families in India in the course of a year, and that just was an overwhelming number to me. The situation that happened with Saru in this movie is one that is a bit extraordinary, but perhaps not. Microphone is going in and out. How about I just turn it off and I'll use this? Okay. We keep trying to figure that out, what it is that's making that happen, but so I'll just use this. So in the movie, the young boys go out. Their mother is a laborer who carries rocks as her work. And, of course, it's not enough to feed three children and her. And so the young boys, when the movie opens, the young boys are scrambling up onto the top of coal-carrying freight trucks so that they can steal the coal and take it to sell it in the market and trade it for food. And they have these big bags, and one throws it down to the other. And there's just this beautiful camaraderie between the two boys. Saru is six, far too young to be hopping on and off moving freight cars to try to take food home to his mother. But the look on his face and the look on her face when he comes home triumphant with his day's win is beautiful. And you can see how the boys are completely compelled, not out of necessity to feed their mother, but out of love, the relationship that exists between them and the beauty of that. And so it doesn't seem that extraordinary when they take off again for some other adventure that's going to bring something home for the family. Though Guru is actually a little bit concerned about taking his younger brother because this is a nighttime excursion. His younger brother isn't used to staying up late at night. And so what happens is he's too tired when they get there and he lies down on a bench. And then when he awakes, his brother has not returned for him. He gets on a train, falls asleep on the train, and then the train, as we know, travels across India and ends up in Calcutta. Watching this young boy act is phenomenal. To see him and the expression on his face, the emotions that he goes through, both in the time that he's with his family and through the time on the train when he's afraid, and then how he draws on his street smarts when he gets to Calcutta and engages in a way that preserves him from some of the other treacheries that are clearly happening on the streets of India, well, with young children who are unhoused, who are separated from their family, who are isolated and living on the street. One of the moving moments in the movie is when Saru, as this young child, is on one side of the subway or train station, sitting there watching a gang of other children who are clearly caring for one another on the other, and one of them eyes him and watches him for a period of time and then slides a piece of cardboard box over for Saru to come over and sleep on the box, his only source of comfort in that space. And later, that group of children is divided as people come in and are gathering them up for probably not good purposes. And the children are racing and running away and screaming and trying to separate so that they're not caught. Saru manages to get away so that he is not caught in that situation and learns, as I said, to fall back on his street smarts. There's one picture where he's seen taking food from an altar and takes that food and survives on it. But a seriously moving moment for me is when he goes back to the train station and packs up his cardboard box, carries it under his arm because that's his only home. So the movie moves through two sections. We watched in Moonlight, we watched three sections of a life being played out in seriatim, showing what's happened in the first part, in the middle part, and the older or the young adult part. This is played out in two parts, really, in terms of age, but three parts in terms of experience. The first is Saru as a young child in the village and as on his own and being picked up and ending up in an orphanage with a number of other children. And then the second part of that very young period is when he is adopted by an Australian family, played by Nicole Kidman, his mother, which one reviewer said, with a distractingly awful red wig, which she does have to wear in the movie. But so those are the two parts in that early part of his life. And then the third part, he's grown up, and he has gone to university. He's working in the hospitality industry and meeting other people until it's his adult life. And during that, there is a moment where he is reminded of some food that used to cook in the marketplace that he always wanted his brother to get him. He's reminded of his childhood when he sees that food at a party. And it's interesting because at the party, he's clearly been brought up in an Australian family's home and is completely unfamiliar with the food of his native country when he's at the party. So he's trying new spicy foods that are, you know, something strange to him, but in the kitchen he recognizes these bright red deep-fried pastries and is immediately sent back to his childhood. At that point, he decides that he's going to find his mother and his family, because the remorse he feels that they have been living all this time not knowing what happened to him, knowing that they would have spent forever looking for him, weeping, crying, trying to find him, he can't live with that lack of resolution in that area of his life. And so he begins this quest. Some reviewers consider that it's an entire Google Earth ad, the movie, because he uses Google Earth to find his hometown, and going in and out and in and out. I was reminded of when we had started the Canadian Center for Progressive Christianity, and a woman had contacted me because her priest had taken her off the rolls because she asked a question about whether a lay preacher's sermon in which that person had stated that salvation was exclusively through Jesus, and she had questioned that. She went to her priest, a young man she had babysat when he was a child, to ask him, is that really what we teach? And the priest had said, yes, absolutely it is. And when she kept trying to talk to him about that, he took her off the rolls of the church and completely abandoned her from that community. And so she had contacted us because she was isolated. So I used Google to go in and out and in and out until I could find another person who had connected with CCPC, who was sort of close to her, and managed to do that. So Google Earth is actually what he used when he was trying to find his family, was using that and the railway system and trying to find a very small thing that he remembered, which was two side-by-side water towers. Excuse me. So he used Google Earth to find that and to make his way back to his family. So there were three sections in each of those movies. And in workshops in the past, I have sometimes asked people to refer to the three different segments in their lives. If each of you takes a moment, take your age, divide it by three, and think of those three sections, the first third of your life, the middle third of your life, and the most recent third of your life. Take a minute to orient yourself to sort of where you were and what you were doing in each of those. And it may be a number of places, but find those three discrete places in your life. One of the things that I think is huge about this movie, one of the many messages that it has for us, or one of the many ways that we can get into talking about it, are the ideas of identity and the ideas of what's normal. So I want you to go to that first third of your life and think about, in that context, what was normal for you? Those of you who have a larger stretch may have a harder time with that, because there may be several things that were normal in there, right? Just, you know. So what are some of the things that were normal for you back then? What was a normal thing in your life? School? Fun? Church? Optimism? Okay. Anything else? And friends? Friends, yes. Opportunity? Family? Affection? Security? School? The great outdoors, sports, sex, playing, I heard that. Playing, yeah, okay. Achievement, okay. Music, to not be with family. There was one over here, adventure, okay. Those are the things that are normal. And if at that point in time you sat down on a plane with someone you'd never seen before, and you know, in that the loss of any inhibition that seems to happen when we're traveling places with people we don't know. You told them all about your life. Those things would have featured large, no doubt. You would have talked, well, you might not have talked about sex on the train, on the plane, but you would have talked about those things that were significant in your life and shared about them with the other person. And they'd have a sense of who you are based on that idea of normal that you had at that time. Let's move to your second third. Are they the same? Like, I'll give you a second to figure what was normal then. Responsibility. Raising children. Sorry? Bearing and rearing, yes. Yeah. As a result of all that sex earlier on. You reap what you sow, right? Anyone else? Challenge? Finances, careers, travel, food, education, volunteering, buying a house, yes, the responsibilities of home ownership. Yes. If you sat down on a plane and wanted to share that with someone that you were with, you would be describing almost a different person than the first normal. There would be, how many of you would be describing the same person? Very few of us, because that our lives change so significantly from one point to another. Now let's get to now, in the last third of our lives. And how would you describe normal for you in this most recent third? Excitement. John, you were caught. Did something you want to share with the class? If you wake up in the morning. That's normal. Okay. Grandchildren. Medical appointments. The loss of a partner. Living alone again. Saving for retirement, which perhaps we should have started in the first third. Longer rebound time. Yes. Do I see a hand over here? No. Loss of family and friends. Travel. Empty nest. Freedom to be what you want without worrying about what? Being accepted? Without upsetting people. Worry about that all you want. Not worrying about that. Okay, sorry. Jim, did you add something? Becoming more accepting of everything. Just taking. And grandchildren, yes. Solidity. Sorry. Check with you again. You've got your cup in your mouth. Canoeing. New activities. The last third. So again, another plane, another destination, another person, and you're telling them who you are, and this is not the person from the first third or the second third? So when we go to root our identity in who we are, there's so many places we could go. The idea of normal, as is sometimes imposed by the world upon us, doesn't often fit exactly. Some of the reading I did this week, there was a counselor who talked about when people come into her therapeutic practice, often one of the first things they say to her is, I just want to be normal. And she says, well, the fact that you actually came to counseling means you're not normal, because most people don't have the courage to show up here to explore what's going on in their lives that has derailed them or derailed their relationships or broken what their understanding of who they should be and who they are is. So what is normal in those terms? And how do we find an identity that is ours separately and distinctly from what the world encapsulates us in? Peter had a picture up just as I was back, and I'm just thinking that it was a picture that Annie put up on the quote slide with the koi fish coming up in the bubble. They've filled the bubble, and then it creates a suction, and so the koi fish comes up and peeks out. It's kind of like we're peeking out at that something that's normal, and there's a drive within us that wants to meet that, whatever it is. But there's the reality that there is no normal even for ourselves in our own lives. There's no normal Christy Cass. She's been different people throughout the course of her life. The same with Alice Farrell and the same with Gary Megson. They've moved from being like this here to being like this here. And when I look back on who I am and I try to figure out what my identity is my identity rooted in the fact that I had a narcissistic father? Or is it rooted in the fact that I had a mother who had an undisciplined love? Two very different normals can come out of those two very different situations, but it was all the same mix. And so my development over my life is grounded in that, but it's very, very different. So as I watched Lion and was so taken by the realities, A, of life in India in the 1980s, which none of us have an understanding of what that is if our experience has been almost exclusively North American. Totally different reality than what we would consider normal in any way. But watching the faces of those kids, you could tell it was so absolutely normal, all the stuff that they were doing, that would curl our hair just thinking about it, about children doing those kinds of things. And then to see Saru as an adult, played by Dev Patel in a beautiful, beautiful role, to see him as an adult functioning as an Australian young man seeking higher education and developing a career path for himself, we can see normal there as something that had absolutely nothing to do with that previous sense of normal. And he falls away from that path when that remorse takes over, and as one person acknowledged, he actually ended up having a mental health crisis because he couldn't function except in relation to that search. So his normal shifted, became disoriented, got completely off track until he was able to find a way to incorporate a new normal. When I do these movie conversations, I'm not talking about the movie most of the time. I'm talking about what the movie brings out in us, in me particularly, and what it is that it encourages me to question. Movies are often entertainment. They're a couple of hours of stepping out of the hassles and the challenges and the stresses or of whatever is normal in our lives to experience something completely different. To head off into another world that we've never seen before. And books do that too. They expose us to emotions that we don't experience in our ordinary everyday lives. I was listening to a reflection on horror movies on the CBC, Bram Stoker's vampire stories and movies, and how horror allows us to, it's sort of cathartic for us. We get all of our built-up fear about life out through a horror film. And the person that was being interviewed said, if you watch people come out of a theater after watching a horror movie, they're often laughing. Like, they've often been scared half to death, and they're laughing their heads off because of that fear. This movie brings us close to a fear that is so primal in all of us, that fear of being separated from our nurturing parents or the family or the orientation of our lives, that separation from it. So we relate deeply to the movie because we all have that very strong innate sense of requiring that connection. And that disorientation that plays out has that same kind of cathartic realization for us as we move through that fear with Saru as a young child, and then the coming back together and mending of it as an adult. It's a cathartic process for all of us. I don't need you to break your life into thirds all the time in order to make sense of that. It's an opportunity for us to reflect on how far we have changed and moved from the roots that grounded us as children. But I would encourage you to watch either of these three-section movies, Moonlight and Lion, as ways of seeing how our roots can nurture us, but they don't necessarily hold us. And our roots can hold us, but not necessarily nurture us. So as we move through life, we carry with us much of what we have written into it as normal over time, as we continue to try to make sense of it and walk it with the integrity that is us. Lion is a phenomenal film, and I would certainly encourage all of you to watch it and to expose yourself a little bit to that sense of, oh my gosh, what if? That may have been had you been in that kind of situation, and that sense of resolution and reconciliation when we come back to knowing that the story we're in is ours, regardless of where it is lived out. Thank you. I don't believe any one of you is entirely rooted in whatever you think is normal now. But I do think that every one of you can be nurtured by what it is that you live as normal, by the relationships that engage you, by the world in which you travel and witness to love. So I invite you to turn into that nurture for others as you leave this place, who may not be rooted in their lives, who may, for whatever reason, feel a disorientation or an unbelonging or loss of connection. And be that nurture. You may never be the roots, but you can be the nurture and you can be the love. So go and be that work in this world. Go in peace.
Listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.